podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hi, my name is Mike Lee. This is part two of our tribute to Tae Venables. If you'll listen to this show first, maybe listen to part one before part two. In this episode, part two, we'll be looking at Tae's time at Crystal Palace, Queen's Park Rangers and Barcelona, and chatting to Palace fan Graham Smith, Queen's Park Rangers fan Alex Lowe, and then the eminent football writer Graham Hunter. Enjoy. Well, we've had an ex-player from this era. Let's talk to a fan who was there throughout this period. TV executive, presenter of the Palace podcast, Graham Smith. How are you, Graham?
I'm super, super duper, thanks.
Let's give the listener a bit of context. Obviously, managerially, he made his name at Crystal Palace. Give us a bit of a background of Palace before Tae Venables, what they'd done, what was the kind of anticipation or what do fans expect trudging there week in, week out?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, obviously, Crystal Palace is the team of Croydon. It's Croydon's team. You know, and I'm from Croydon, my family's from Croydon. And, you know, I'm a supporter because my dad was a supporter of the club from the 1930s, you know. So, you know, and it's slightly more in that era in the 60s. You know, obviously there were glory hunters, but you generally followed your local team. You know, Palace was my local team. And up until the late 60s, they'd been middling, bumped along on the, you know, the lower leagues.
Like third division south for a lot of the time.
Yes. Yeah, really, for a long time. And then in the sort of late 60s, they're in the old second division. And under Bert Head was the manager. And suddenly they started doing better than they had done. You know, they'd never really had stars or anything.
And who were the owners? Anyway, who was it, local businessmen owning it?
Yeah, it had always traditionally been local businessmen.
Right.
As with most football clubs, yeah. You know, football clubs were the fiefdoms of your local, you know, Rotary Society, the local car dealers and et cetera. And Palace was no different. Palace was no different. In fact, there was a group of owners in the 40s, and they basically passed the chairmanship between them. It was like a little club of ownership. Anyway, so in the 60s, so I go to my first match, Easter 1969. My brother takes me. We're doing well in the second division. We play Middlesbrough. It's a draw. That's my first time I go to Selhurst Park. My second game was our first game when we'd got promotion into the first division. So it's August, September 1969, our first game, Manchester United. And this is when Palace held 50,000 people. Manchester United, it was the great Manchester United, although at that point they were fading. They were fading. And it was, you know, a pulsating game. And it was a 2-2 draw. And so suddenly it's just like Palace had, we were in the first division and we held our own, you know. So, you know, there were moments of Sporting Palace. It's like a desert with a very occasional lush oasis of joy. And then you move on and you're in the desert again, you know. Yeah. So we had all that. So fast forward to 1976.
I mean, just going back there, because just again, people think Venables played there in Palace 74. I think he came in, Don Rogers went the other way. He made 14th appearances, gave up knee injury, arthritis in his knee. And then Malcolm Allison gave him a coaching role in that second half of that campaign. So a young Venables, just retired from playing, is working under the great Malcolm Allison.
Yes, yeah, and the things. But and bear in mind that now you know we there are two relegations.
Yeah.
You know, in the 1970 we'd been in the first division. By 1975-76 we're in the third division. You know, we're in the equivalent of League One. Mm. But we have this super flamboyant manager. We have, you know, Malcolm Allison with his cashmere coat and his fedora and photographs of him in the player's bath with Fiona Richmond, you know, things like that. He brought this sort of rather confusing glamour to the Palace. And he'd be walking out on the pitch and he'd be waving and then of course the latter half of that 75-76 season, we had this amazing cup run. And so obviously, you know, Venables is on the coaching staff. So he's sort of, at that point, he's sort of quietly in the background because Malcolm Allison is the figurehead. And then we have this amazing cup run. And, you know, and I went as a 15-year-old, you know, I went to those two really memorable games, the quarterfinal against Chelsea at Stamford Bridge. Peter Taylor, by then Peter Taylor was our star. You know, Peter Taylor, I believe, scored a match-winning free kick. So we're at Stamford Bridge. We beat Chelsea in their own backyard, a third division club, which was, again, one of those brief oases of glory. And then it's the semi-final against Southampton.
Who was second division team, yeah.
Yes, who then... And it was like a massive disappointment.
Didn't play well. A lot of players there said if it was a sort of grey, rainy day, but it was a bright, sunny day and we just didn't get going. They're very, very disappointed.
Yeah, lost 2-0. And it was very underwhelming. After the glory of the Chelsea game, it was just very disappointing. Anyway, so now we're in the Venables era.
Yeah, and so Venables, you know, apparently Allison, when he moved on, he recommended Venables to the board. He said, he's your man.
Yes, absolutely. And Venables then built a steady, job building the club up. You know,
with very little money. He sold Taylor to Tottenham for $200,000. So that was the main money, I assume, that was used to bring all these kind of young players and journeyman players into the team.
Indeed. But bear in mind, the owner of the club at this time is a guy called Ray Bloy. You know, right. Ray Bloy, another sort of local businessman. And so on the pitch, everything's going, brilliantly. And then we have the glorious night in 79, beating Burnley. And we're promoted to the First Division, back in the First Division. We're back. And you know what? This time, we're the team of the 80s. Which is like when you see those old films about, you know, and slaves and slaves walking along with a massive weight around their neck. That's ours. And on the weight is written Team of the 80s. Yeah. And we will never be able to forget. Oh, Crystal Palace, yeah, Team of the 80s. Yeah. So, you know. And so, you know, we had the promotion the first season up. We do okay. We do
well. Well, you're top. For 1 week, you're top.
Yeah.
You finished.
Rather like in 1965, Herman's Hermits were very briefly bigger than the Beatles.
Yeah. but that season, you said you're okay. You finished mid-table, which then was the club's ever, the highest ever league finish. So think things are good. Then what went wrong?
Well, clearly, I mean, obviously, as we know, you know, the season started badly and quite quickly, Venables is off to his one of the clubs closest to his heart will probably Chelsea, QPR, and then we're down.
Tottenham as well.
He goes to QPR. But obviously there are massive issues going on at the club because, you know, a few months after he leaves, Bloy is out and Ron Nodes is in. I can't remember, you might have the facts to hand, whether we actually go into administration in early 1981. But that is the point where Ray Bloy leaves and Ron Nodes comes in.
Do you think that kind of story though is kind of repeated by so many clubs? You're traditionally a small club, you go for it, you get success, you get a bit of money, you start spending that money, but it's not enough money. You don't have enough money. It's keeping up the Joneses football-wise. Then you start struggling, and then there's not enough money to cover these wages. And I mean, it happens. It still happens. I mean, it absolutely happens.
I mean, it's still exactly the same now with Crystal Palace. There was a very interesting story. I don't know when this is going to go out, but a very interesting story about debt from Daniel Story in the Independent, just about what Crystal Palace is now. You know, and that we're a mediocre mid-table, if we're lucky, Premiership side. You know, decrying the tactics of Hodgson. And the lack of ambition of the owners. But I think our current owners, at least they've learned the lesson of, you know, financial madness ends in disaster, you know, and it's like Palace has been through it several times, and several people have lost fortunes because of it, you know.
Yes, of course.
So, although,
but how are you at this particular era? How do you look back at that time under Terry Venables?
Oh, you know, it was briefly a golden era, a golden era, you know, and he built up from, you know, Malcolm Allison's that joyful FA Cup run in 1976, and he'd slowly built it up there over 3 years. And so, you know, you get into 1979 and 1980, and it's just like, you know, we've never had it so good, but it never lasts. It never lasts. And being a Palace fan, it never lasts. And the thing is about Palace, and this is a terrible thing to say as a long line, we've been in the Prem 10 years, you know. Crystal Palace are a natural championship side. That's what they are. And one of these seasons, we will go down. One of these seasons, we will have a bad season and we'll go down like Southampton, you know, or Bournemouth might this year, you know, all those clubs who, you know, you make one bad mistake with a signing, you get too many injuries and you have a few bad decisions on the pitch and suddenly, you know, it can be very precarious, you know. So we're in this position even now of every point is precious, and you're always looking 5 games ahead. Oh God, we've got Bournemouth, we've got West Ham, we've got Bournemouth, we've got Liverpool, we've got Brighton, we've got Chelsea. How many points are we going to get? Can we get 5 points? That's how you think all the time, you know. And it's a nothing changes, you know.
And then he obviously moved to Queen's Park Rangers as a manager, and I'm joined now by the actor, comedian, raconteur, Mr. Alex Lowe. How are you, Alex?
Very well, thank you. I'm delighted you're doing this retrospective.
Well, I think, you know, I think he's kind of, there's been some lovely tributes to him in the papers and stuff, but again, you know, they do focus mainly on England, obviously.
Yes.
Barcelona. But I mean, I wouldn't say early days, obviously started at Palace, but at QPR, who were then a second division team, huge success again and a great side.
Yeah, and an absolute hero to QPR fans. You know, it was one of those managers where you had total faith in him. I suppose the thing is about the plastic pitch, 82, 83, which is very much the time I was in there week in, week out in the Loftus Road end. I was only, you know, a mere slip of a 14, 15-year-old. But there was a lot of talk at the time, I remember, from other jealous teams that, oh, Rangers have got this plastic pitch. That's why they were successful. Not a bit of it, because our away record was incredible. And in that season, under Eltel, we... not Eltel in those days, of course. we won the second division championship and we got into the FA Cup final against Spurs.
That's right.
So, you know, an absolute. My uncle was on the board at QPR.
Oh, really?
Yes, and he was even deputy chairman when Jim Gregory was ill for a bit, and because my uncle used to be managing director of Hoover,
right?
Perivale,
right? Yes, yes.
Okay. So quite often when, of course, in those days I'd be in the Loftus Road end, didn't want to be with the prawn sandwich brigade up in the director's box. But, you know, I met Terry Venables around about that time, a huge thrill. And yeah, I mean, he was tactically brilliant. I've no doubt he probably got people in like Simon Stainrod and these, whether at that time, maybe totally different to nowadays, there was such a thing as a bargain, but people like Stainrod came in, absolute hero, with a coveted QPR number 10 shirt. So, yeah, I would say Terry's an absolute folk hero with Rangers.
And the style of football was interesting because as a Tottenham fan, I remember playing, it was always a hard game. But defensively, you were pretty clued up. He liked the offside track, which a lot of people say he passed on to his mate George Graham, who then went on to win the league with Arsenal, playing that kind of style, all the hand going up and all that. He did that. He had a strong, I think, was it Bob Hazel at the back, strong centre-half. He still had Gillard and Shanks there. Glenn Roeder, beautifully cultured player.
Brilliant. We had Warren Neal, Ian Dawes at the back. Terry Fenwick, as you say. Yeah, really. I mean, that was really frustrating. I always remember Emlyn Hughes and Rotherham turning up once and just being so frustrated. I mean, that was always the perennial cry. It's there to be beaten, the offside trap. And people used to get frustrated and say it was awful. And then in the same breath, they've got their bouncy pitch. And like my players doing sliding tackles and what have you. But yeah, master tactician in those days. And also really exciting with people like John Gregory, also very cultured midfielder who played for England as well. So it was exciting. I think Stan had left just before then, but we certainly had Tony Curry, Simon Stainrod, you know, as I say, John Gregory, really cultured, great player.
He liked a stylish player, didn't he, throughout his time, whether it was Gascoigne or whatever. He always loved that kind of maverick player. And he seemed to get the best out of maverick players, where a lot of kind of traditional down managers just couldn't handle them.
I think that's probably right. And you kind of imagine he was probably a bit of a wheeler dealer, bit of a, you know, a player himself, journeyman player. I imagine, you know, players respond to that hugely.
Mm. And I mean, that 82, I mean, again, it's very rare. Obviously, Southampton had done it in 76, being a second division team. I think Ipswich as well. But, you know, to get into the cup final 82, when you had then a big Liverpool team and big sides. And there was the famous game, it was the quarterfinal, when you played Crystal Palace, his old club, and of course Clive Allen's old club. And famously, Allen scored, and then a bit like Adebayor did for Man City against Arsenal, ran the length of the pitch to give it to the Palace fans. That was very controversial at the time.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and of course, he also scored in the semi-final against West Brom.
West Brom, who are a very, 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 very strong team as well then.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember Bob Hazel being superb that day. But I mean, Clive Allen, just this is off the subject of Terry Venables, but, you know, that was often said about that semi-final, that, oh, it just bounced off his foot. But you have to be a real poacher to get in that position.
Yeah.
To score a goal like Clive Allen. So, yeah, were some great players at the time. And, of course, you know, poor old Rangers really, really deserved to win that replay against Spurs.
Well, the replay they did, the first game, again, they weren't good games for the neutral, even fans there. Tottenham had a very, very long season, 50-odd games, loads of games at the end of the season. They got over the line. But certainly when in that first game when Tottenham took the lead, the deflector shot, Hoddle, you kind of thought that was it. But then late on, set pieces. We talked about his defensive qualities. He loved a set piece for many of his teams. And it was you mentioned Bob Hazel there, the flick on and Terry Fenwick getting in between the two defenders. Extraordinary. And you couldn't argue that that QPR didn't deserve that replay.
Absolutely. I mean, also arguably, maybe, I mean, I'm always slagging off VAR, but arguably we had a perfectly good goal from Gary Micklewhite. John Gregory hit the bar. I don't know whether that was a cross or a shot. But, yeah, I mean, so sad for poor old QPR, you know. But what a season to do that. Get in the cup final, win the league, as I say, with a fantastic away record. And it was thrilling to watch.
I don't remember, because obviously after that, I mean, again, a second division, okay, you know, the first division manager, fifth in the league, to go to Barcelona. I don't, he got you fifth, 83-84. You qualified for the UEFA Cup. I know he wasn't there then, but do you remember those UEFA Cup games, how they went?
I remember a match at, I think we played at Highbury, and I don't know what that was, but we did have a match there, and that was in that European campaign. I was going out with a girl at the time. I spent a lot of time with her and less time with football, so I'm not so good on that. I can tell you about her, though. But it was great. And when you look at poor old QPR now, I think that maybe there was just more room for that in those days. Maybe it was much more egalitarian time. But I can't see QPR A, getting into Europe anytime soon, and B, moving their manager on to Barcelona.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that obviously Venables is famous for, because it was quite rare to be talked about at the time, his off the field activities, writing Hazel, co-writing Hazel. with Nicholas Ball. He had a board game. He had a sort of, you know, he loved to sing. He had Scribes West. There aren't many of those kind of managers anymore that you might see down a West End bar doing some karaoke surrounded by Mad Frankie Fraser and whoever. I mean, Fiona Richmond, famously.
I know. It's a real shame particularly as a sort of comedy writer and a satirist, you know, to have those people. Everything's so flipping squeaky clean. I was thinking about Gary O'Neill, you know, the Wolves manager, suddenly comes in, and where we've had, and this is, sounds vaguely racist, but where we've had these European, and I know you're out in Portugal, Portuguese managers. I mean, it's more than a coincidence that this guy comes in who's played football in the Premiership, who's played at the level of these guys, and he talks their language. And I've seen him talking in the dressing room. And it's the kind of talk that fires them up. And I wonder whether Terry was the same sort of thing. He's speaking the language of these working class English blokes.
Yeah, I think you're right.
The case of Wolves.
Well, let's finish off now. It's only fair. Let's because we've discussed it. Let's listen now to certainly some of the highlights of the 82 Cup final. Let's have a listen now.
Oh, good tackle by Hoddle on Waddock. Roberts. Hoddle, it's there, he won it with the tackle and he scored the goal. Glenn Hoddle, the pride of Tottenham, has sent the fans delirious again. Steinrod with the long throw for Queen's Park Rangers. Roberts, it was Hazel's flick, and Fenwick was in there, and it's a goal. Terry Fenwick. The set-piece ploy works again. Fenwick is the scorer. 5 minutes left, and it's Rangers' turn to celebrate, and the long throw works again. Simon Steinrod took it. Watch for the flick on by Bob Hazel, number 5. Watch Terry Fenwick come in at the far post, and the header over Ray Clements' head. It's 1-1. A replay for only the third time in Wembley history, and the second time in consecutive years, now seems certain. And the whistle confirms the fact. Terry Fenwick from the northeast saves the Cockney Cup final for Queen's
Alex,
Park.
Thank you so much for your time. You have, for those of you who don't know, you are the face, the mask, whatever you want to call it, behind the huge success of Clinton Baptiste. Another tour coming up. Where can people get tickets and where are you playing?
Yeah, please go to clintonbaptiste.com/tour. I've got 100 dates up and down the country. The moment I get off this call, I've got to get back to writing the flipping thing. So, thank you very much for that, Mike.
Wow, you're like the Bruce Springsteen of character comedy, these never-ending tours.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
Lovely. Thanks, Alex. I'm joined now by the football writer Graham Hunter, who resides in Barcelona, to talk about that sort of seismic move. I can't think of many top British managers who went overseas at that time. I think Vic Buckingham was probably the first back in the 60s. Graham, thank you so much for joining us on this tribute to Terry Venables.
Like, I'm really pleased to. Clearly, I didn't know Terry at the time he moved to Barcelona. I was still making a big move of my own from Aberdeen to Glasgow then.
I'm sure you were a snip of a boy. Snip of a boy early 80s.
No. I ain't that young, sadly. But I did get to know Terry, what I would call, reasonably well. We spent social time together. I went down latterly to see him in his hotel near Alicante. But I also talked to him about football a lot. We coincided in both in Barcelona and in London. And I think just by admitting to him or by explaining to him how much of an admirer I was of him individually, his football, his daring, how he expressed himself. I was a big fan of the Hazel books, you know, James Hazel.
Yes, that's right.
Which subsequently been made in, was made in a TV. Nicholas Ball, the actor.
Yeah.
They made it a TV series, but I read the books that he co-wrote, or at least he gave the inspiration for. And I really, really, really liked Terry an awful lot. And frankly, he was good to me too. So it's a sad thing to have a Christmas coming up, a World coming up, a change of year coming up where there's no Terry around anymore. But it's a pleasure to be talking to you about him.
Yeah, that's lovely. I mean, he obviously moved to Barcelona, a team who hadn't won the Liga since 1974. And he's gone from a relatively small club in QPR. I believe Bobby Robson put a word in. What's your understanding of that
he
move?
He did. No, he did. I've spoken to both Bobby and Terry about this because, again, I was perhaps even more friendly with Bobby. Bobby phoned me when I was in London and he was leaving what had become a worldwide scouting role to ostensibly to chat, but then to ask whether he wanted to know whether I thought he should go back to Newcastle or not, which was Bobby was an eccentric, idiosyncratic man, but I was confused by him asking my opinion, but asked my opinion he did. But we talked about Terry, and it was the case that Bobby, I guess you've had such an exhaustive tribute that you'll have to button and stop me.
It's fine. That's the beauty of it. It's open-ended. It's an open-ended tribute.
the thing that really counts is that Bobby Robson's Ipswich had really impressed because they were playing when they won the UEFA Cup, they were playing a style of football which was outstandingly different to what you saw as general fare in English First Division at a time when English clubs were obviously repeatedly exceptionally successful in Europe, but partly because of Bobby Robson's attitudes, partly because of some high-quality footballers that he was able to get from the home nations. But I think because of the influence of the way that Franz Tyson and Arlen Muren played, Ipswich looked and felt different on the ball, how they wanted to run games, and that caught the attention. And the reason it caught the attention, particularly at Barcelona, because if you want to understand why Terry, it's accurate to say that Bobby Robson recommended him, but it's not enough, not by any means. Terry came to a place, and nor is it enough to say, you know, they hadn't won the league title since Johan Cruyff arrived as a player. That's not quite enough. What was happening was, I don't know if your listeners know, but Spain had been a dictatorship until 1985. One of the areas of Spain that had been most damaged by that was Catalonia. Barcelona is the biggest city in Catalonia. By no means were the only ones damaged. The Basque country didn't fare well under the dictator, General Franco. He died in 75, but like with any social and political change, it normally, you throw the stone into the pond, the ripples take a long time. So by, let's say, the 1980, they're beginning to plan for semi-autonomy and a parliament in Catalonia. So suddenly they're in this this spring whereby everything's optimistic. Everything is, we want to be self-determining. We want to throw off the shackles of, I mean, remember, they've been under a dictatorship since the late 30s. And therefore it really was an effervescent time of change. And one of the things that was happening was at Camp Nou, they were looking at, why are we not a successful club? Well, it wasn't simply, by any means, people should think of Barcelona did not resemble the club that they have been in the 90s onwards until today, whereby they're still regarded today as a sizable, important club. From the 90s until now, they've been deeply influential in people's ideas of what a star footballer is, what flowing football should be. That bears no relationship to what Terry was about to take over. In the early 80s, remember, the league was consistently won by Real Sociedad and Athletic Club. Real Madrid hadn't won the European Cup at that stage until, I think, the mid-60s, maybe 65, 66. But nonetheless, Real Madrid were a far more successful club. They were a far more popular club. And as such, when you think about Atleti being even then the established third force in Spanish football, Barcelona were in real danger at that stage of, if not becoming an also-ran, becoming, you know, in tier five or six of Spanish football. Now think about that before anybody thinks about how odd it was that they went to QPR. And although Terry had proven himself as, first of all, interested in lots of different methods, I'm sure you've talked about the, you know, the sprinting and the athletics that he introduced at Crystal Palace, the way in which he wanted his players to be athletically strong, athletically quick, the way in which he coached the, you know, the team of the 80s, the fact that QPR got promoted and went to the final of the FA Cup. All those things are interesting, and they were significant for a young coach like Terry. But to vault him into Football Club Barcelona, well, that only happens when Barcelona say we're starting a search for how to do things differently. We're starting a search for relevance, and they were willing to take risks. Until that time, yeah, they'd taken risks with a Hungarian or an Argentinian or a Dutch coach, but it had never been on their radar until Ipswich attracted their attention and they spoke to Bobby Robson. And I think at that stage, Bobby knew that the England job was coming, and he turned them down specifically because for the moment he was very happy, but he was already convinced that he would get the England job. And as such, he wasn't willing to throw everything in and at that stage go and manage Football Club Barcelona.
So when Venables went in, you know, famously, you know, and I know you're a mutual friend with Steve Archibald, first thing that happened is Archie's coming and Maradona's going the other way from Barcelona, because Venables decided after a bit of training, you've already mentioned how he wanted to play, he didn't think Maradona would fit into the way he wanted the team to play. That's you need huge balls to do that, don't you?
Yeah, I don't know who's told you that, but that's a version of it, I'd have to say, because Football Club Barcelona is an institute that runs its transfer business irrespective of the coach. And there were, you know, in May, long before the season finished, before Terry took over formally, Napoli had begun negotiations, had come over. Maradona wasn't happy with his life. He needed more money. He'd begun, while the Butcher of Bilbao and Donny Goycochea had damaged Maradona's leg so badly, and then there'd been the Athletic Bilbao Barcelona Cup final where they ended up kung fu kicking each other. Maradona had begun to dose his pain with cocaine, and this wasn't unknown. And there was a move from the version of the mafia in Napoli that they could bring a superstar that they could tend to his off pitch needs. And great, they got the best of him. But there was a point at which when Terry had been announced as the incoming manager, but the previous season hadn't finished, where Terry went to watch the European Cup final in Rome between Liverpool and Roma, and on the way back gave an interview to the Spanish media about, like, I'd like the president, you know, Napoli had flown over in the days around that final, had flown over to Camp Nou and had begun trying to prize Maradona out of Camp Nou. And Terry was widely quoted as saying, I'd like the president, President Nunez, to slow down. Let's wait and think. And Terry may well have looked at Maradona in training and decided he didn't need him. Listen, I hope you knew Terry in life, but anybody you've spoken to, anybody who did know him would say that Terry was exactly the type of man who'd be like, Maradona's gone, I don't care. I'm Terry Venables. We'll cope without him. But the tectonic plates were moving. Maradona didn't want to stay. Barcelona were looking for a change of environment. They hadn't been particularly successful with Maradona there, remember. No league title. And, you know, some cup finals, won and lost. It really hadn't been what it was supposed to be in any way. And it was ultimately, it was definitely better for both parts that they moved. And frankly, if it was better for Terry. If Terry had been there having to cope with Maradona's behaviour, which at Barcelona was reductive and anarchic and it was distracting, whereas in Napoli, it fitted the this is quite a conservative city. And back then, even though in the early 80s it was beginning to say, we are independent, we are free thinking, the Catalan culture has no comparison at all to what Terry was most famous as a player in swing in London in the 60s. No comparison at all to the Napoli that Maradona went to. And as such, it was far better for Terry Venables that Diego Maradona left. Infamously, I don't know if you've spoken to Steve about this, when the 10 shirt went a-begging, Steve's lucky number was 8. He was desperate to have 8. Schuster was established. He was the big star. Terry buckled, which was unlike Terry, but he said, no, Schuster's got to keep 8. And Schuster wouldn't take 10, was scared of the number, the Maradona number. And Steve was like, yeah, I'll take that. Because Steve and Terry are kind of like different animals in some ways, but they're both geezers. You know, they're both rock solid in their opinion in themselves. And what I would say is that Terry came into a club where it was reeling. Like, it was genuinely, nobody listening should think that he came into the type of club that Pep Guardiola took over, or Rijkaard came over, or even the type of club that that Johan Cruyff reshaped before it began winning and winning and winning. Terry's job was very, very, very big indeed. I personally think it's... I'll let you get a question in any second now. I personally think that his work and his achievements and his impact on Catalan football are deeply, deeply undervalued.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. Absolutely. What did he do? Did he kind of bring in a sort of classic English style? That's what he did when he went in there? How did he try and shape things, from your understanding?
I think as a team, first of all, they were distinctly more organised. They had a tough and very successful back four, and extremely characterful and agile, not particularly tall, goalkeeper called Urruti, who had a character a little bit similar to Emilio Martinez at the moment at Villa, where it was like me against the world. I'll produce heroics. He was also a massive inspirational character, beloved by the team, absolutely beloved by the team. And that foundation, Mike, I think at the back, probably the most, not everybody listening to this will know the names, but the two most famous names at the back would be Migueli, who was a Carlos Puyol style figure. Who would I compare him to? Not Perryman, not Mabbott, but not Cyril Knowles. But if you can pluck for me a Spurs man who was there forever, who was hard as nails.
The Graham Roberts type, would you say Graham Roberts
type?
Yeah,
there's a shout now. There's a really good shout. More modern, but yeah, you've nailed that in terms of will to win, body on the line, growling others, intimidating opponents. Migueli was very, very, nicknamed Tarzan. Very, very popular, very important, Terry. Julio Alberto, a Spanish international fullback who was extremely talented, not a wing back, but still prone to venturing forward. Got a crucial goal in the quarterfinal of the European Cup to beat Juventus at Camp Nou. Subsequently, again, dabbled with drugs, jumped out of a hotel window, survived that. He's still with us today, but has had a troubled life since, but was again central for Terry. And I think if you think about, there was a very skillful player called Calderi. He Naim was given game time, lots of game time, or increasing game time by Terry, and became important. Steve was brought in to huge effect. That Steve brought a steal, skill, big goals.
Because I think, was it Hugo Sanchez or someone that the club wanted to sign? And apparently, I think Steve tells the story that he's in one room and Steve's in the other room. He's like, am I coming here or not? What's going on?
This is exactly the point I'm making about the club. The club felt themselves all powerful. They did not necessarily treat you particularly well. This is my point about the Maradona thing. Yes, they were trying for Sanchez. They failed. Yes, Steve went into a meeting thinking originally that he was the golden child, and Terry wanting Steve, but the club double dealing. And if you speak to Steve now, his effects, he's still, I think, in touch with Gaspart, who was the Juan Gaspart was the vice president, but he was the doer. He was the people remember Nunez, a builder, construction magnate, who was a Basque. He wasn't Catalan, and there was a double act of a preening small man syndrome president and a smart, busy, multilingual vice president, and they did what they wanted to a certain extent. And yeah, Steve very nearly didn't get his dream move, but Brent Schuster at that stage, in my opinion, was a sublime, supreme midfielder. Again, if people don't, I'm old, but if people don't understand him, it'll make me sad, because Schuster, who eventually played for Atleti and Real Madrid as well as Barcelona, was a sensational ball-playing, free-kick-taking, sort of flash and flop of blonde hair, really glamorous football guy who I still work with to this day, and he's extremely interesting and fun and speaks very good English. Didn't so much, I think, then, but he was Steve's roommate. But he was a special, special footballer, I promise you. I guess you, because you're a football lover, I guess you remember him. Or
yes, I remember Schuster, yes.
So there were elements that were really important across the team there. But to answer your question, what Terry brought in, I think, was a certain degree of physical fitness, an organisation whereby, let me give you a stat, for example. You pointed out that Barcelona hadn't won the title for, what was it, maybe
74, I think was the last one, yeah.
74. And therefore they weren't used to posting stats like this. But under Terry, I mean, the key story in that first season is the first game. But under Terry, they didn't lose a league match until mid-December. They only lost one more the remainder of the season. So they're two defeats off an unbeaten season, and they win the title. They beat Real Madrid twice, and I think that key story...
Yeah, that was for the listeners who don't know, the first game was away to Real Madrid. And they won 4-0, 3-0, 4-0.
It's almost unheard of, Mike. The classical now, it's a stage thing. It's like a rugby. It's like a set play. Everybody knows what's going to happen. Nobody actually, you know, tries for the ball that much. And it's just like, up we go. Now it's like middle of October and middle of spring. And that's it. So in inverted commas, the Clásico isn't wasted in some date that people don't care about. That day was the Barcelona at Madrid on the opening day of the season. I mean, I think it's unheard of before, or certainly not since. And they go there, and, you know, Terry's grown up. And I mean, listen, Terry got married, didn't he, on the morning of a North London derby. You know, played in North London derbies and played for Chelsea against the other London clubs, and therefore knew a little bit of edge, you know, when he saw it, really. And at Palace as well, it wasn't as bumpy as, but as coach of Palace, he'd seen a few things. You talk to either Terry or Steve about that first game. The police escort is next to zero. It disappears as they get closer to the Bernabeu. The coach is stoned. The windows are smashed. You know, you think of these stories, I suppose, in Argentina or, you know, really lawless Italy of the 70s. Well, no, this was the Barcelona team coach. Now it's a TV set piece. And the bus arrival and the fans there and the cops everywhere. There would be an outright scandal if that happened. There'd be a worldwide story. And at that stage, of course, football is not a worldwide instant story. And they're on the floor of the bus, hiding from shattered glass as they arrive at the Bernabeu. And yeah, you're right. Steve opens the scoring. First senior goal for Barcelona is at Bernabeu, you know, 3-0 win at Real Madrid. It, you know, intentions set. They subsequently beat Victor Munoz, another key footballer who played 80, 90 times for Spain, and ultimately joined Steve at St Mirren. Victor Munoz is sent off in the return Clásico at Camp Nou. They have 10 men for 60 minutes. They still win 3-2. In fact, a 3-1 up until Butragueño scores in the last minute. And I'll throw in a fact that people disregard a lot because it was a sort of baby tournament, the League Cup in Spain. But in 85 or 86? I think it's 86. It is 86, sorry. In May 86, Terry wins the League Cup for Barcelona, beating Betis in the final. But in the quarterfinals, They pumped Real Madrid 6-2. 4-0 at the Bernabeu, 2-2 at Camp Nou. And, you know, you think to yourself, the victories against Real Madrid, the League Cup win, the league win, the way they qualify for the European Cup final, you think, how the hell was he out of a job?
Yes.
By 1987.
Yeah.
Times were different. Cruyff was arriving. Cruyff was just the way in which Van Gaal was on the conveyor belt to bump out Bobby Robson. The club were immediately that Cruyff became a coach. They were watching closely. And I think, although there were a couple of dodgy results, the way that the Stade Bucharest final was lost, the two defeats to Dundee United in Europe, these things sealed Terry's fate. But in honest truth, I think that within the club, they saw him as an icebreaker. They saw him as a changer of the times. And I personally don't believe that they saw Terry as, you know, somebody, there's a 10-year man. We repeatedly give him faith. We back him. The message was amongst the board, Cruyff's coming. Right. And Terry did them the job. He wasn't asked to develop the way in which Cruyff did the youth systems. He wasn't asked to rewrite the wiring of the entire club. He was told, win us things. Win. And he flipping well did.
He certainly did. That's amazing. Graham, thank you so much for your time and your memories and thoughts of that golden time. I mean, as I said at the top there, I can't think of many British managers. I mean, after him, we had Toshack famously there and a few others. But he really was a trendsetter, wasn't he, Venables?
Kendall went there as well. You know, and now I think it's far more. Butler subsequently got Bobby Robson back, approached Alex Ferguson twice. You're right, it became in vogue. And although there had been a history of British, you know, 60, 70 years before, there'd been a history of British coaches in Spain, there had been a 50, 60 year gap. So Terry was a trendsetter. And listen, if we're tying a ribbon and saying goodbye, let me tell you that when, you know, Terry, unfortunately, when he got there, became single again, his relationship broke up, and there was a club called the Up and Down Club in Barcelona, up near where I am now. And there's a hotel called the Princesa Sofia, which is at the top of the hill, looking down at the Camp Nou. And Terry sort of held court in the bar as you came in the front door in the giant, elegant lobby. There was a bar on the right-hand side. And Terry would hold court there for friends or prospective players or agents or the media. And he lived well. He lived happily. He looked like a player. He was slim. He was tanned. He was fit. He was having a really good life. Him and Alan Harris enjoyed themselves there. Graham Turner was his interpreter. I'm still friends with Graham and his daughter, Lucy. And it was a burgeoning, I think, largely happy, impressive time that trampolined Terry up to what he achieved at Spurs and England later on. And I promise you, we're talking about, you know, although it's a sad time to say goodbye to Terry, we're talking about a time that was fecund and it was glorious and it was happy and it was confidence and reputation building for Terry.
That was part two of our tribute to Terry Venables. Join us very, very soon for part three, the final part, when we'll be looking at his time at Tottenham Hotspur, England, and then his return to Crystal Palace. Join us soon.
Sports Social Podcast Network.